Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Ukraine, nearly 80 days into the Russian invasion, UN humanitarians and partners have warned that TB and HIV patients are at particular risk from having their life-saving treatment regimes interrupted. According to UNAIDS, an estimated 260,000 people live with HIV in Ukraine, the second highest proportion in Eastern Europe and Central Asia after Russia. Of that number, more than 150,000 are on antiretroviral therapy, medication that people with HIV need to take every day to stay alive and well. Although there are sufficient stocks of medicine in the country, the fact that some 8 million people are now displaced inside Ukraine has prompted concerns that those in need of HIV and TB drugs may not be able to get them. Here's Andriy Klepikov from the NGO Global Fund speaking in Geneva.
Logistics is very complicated. Some of the roads are destroyed and people are mobile and some of them hiding in quite remote locations from the war. So that's why we are helping them to deliver medicines and to maintain contacts by phone, by social media, because it's also an important part. So not only provide pills, but also motivate, keep motivation of people to take medicines.
Echoing that message, UNITAID spokesperson Hervé Vahoussel told UN News that the agency's TB projects in Ukraine have been affected by the war, but that every effort must be made to ensure that all patients with TB or HIV receive their medicines on time. A top UN-appointed independent rights expert on terrorism is to make an official visit to the Maldives, where efforts are underway to reintegrate nationals who fought in conflicts abroad. Fionnuala Ni-Alouane, who's spending 9 days in the Maldives from the 15th to the 24th of May, will visit detention centres, where she'll interview people suspected or convicted of terrorism-related activities and extremist crimes. One of the aims of Ms. Ni-Alouane's visit is to identify good practices in the return, rehabilitation and reintegration of foreign fighters and women and children with alleged links to designated terrorist groups in places like Syria, her office said in a statement on Friday. The issue has been a long-standing concern of UN-appointed independent rights experts who've joined repeated appeals to dozens of countries to take back all of their nationals still held in detention in Syria's infamous Al-Hol camp complex. Located in northeast Syria, Al-Hol is home to some 65,000 people and an estimated 10,000 foreign nationals who've endured terrible conditions. They include the former wives, children and relatives of ISIL fighters. Ms. Ni-Alouane, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms while Countering Terrorism, also plans to meet government representatives in the Maldives along with law enforcement officials and policy specialists. She will present a comprehensive report with her findings and recommendations to the UN Human Rights Council in March next year. Special rapporteurs and independent experts, like Ms. Ni-Alouane, received their mandates from the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. They operate in their individual capacity and are neither UN staff nor are they paid for their work. A new UN-led push to prevent an arms race in outer space has received wide-ranging support and participation from member states and civil society at talks in Geneva. The first open-ended working group on reducing space threats that's been meeting all week in the Swiss city is the result of a UN General Assembly resolution last December seeking to promote norms, rules and principles of responsible behaviours among countries present in the cosmos or which are planning to be present in orbit. An international treaty for outer space already exists that forms the basis of international space law, but it is 55 years old and needs updating urgently to take account of new space-based threats to global security and the fact that all nations rely on space today for navigation, communication, broadband and finance, explained Helmut Lagos, chair of the working group talks.
That treaty is actually the cornerstone of the international space regime. That is still true. But at the same time, we need to see what other norms, principles and rules can be negotiated to fill the legal gaps that are there, considering how the space environment has evolved in the last couple of decades, dramatically.
Helmut Lagos ending that item. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, the Human Rights Council in Geneva voted on Thursday to increase scrutiny on what's happening in Ukraine after the Russian invasion. In addition to that story, we'll be heading to Afghanistan for the latest alarming UN assessments on food insecurity there, to the occupied West Bank after the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, and to DPR Korea, where the World Health Organization is committed to help stop the spread of COVID-19. The good news is that we have some good news in the form of successful malaria vaccine trials, which could save tens of thousands of children's lives. Stay with us for that. And of course, closing comments from Solange Berhetegui-Cortez. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. The UN Human Rights Council met in special session on Thursday in Geneva, prompted by increasing concern over atrocities committed against civilians following Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. A mounting number of reports and testimonies point to possible war crimes in Ukraine, particularly in areas controlled until recently by Russian forces, said UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet.
These killings of civilians often appear to be intentional, carried out by snipers and soldiers. Civilians were killed when crossing the road or leaving their shelters to seek food and water.
Highlighting the latest harrowing findings of UN investigators in the Kyiv and Chernihiv regions, Ms. Bachelet told the forum that 1,000 civilian bodies had been found in the Kyiv region alone. Some had been killed in hostilities, but others appeared to have been summarily executed. In Afghanistan, more than 19 million people face acute hunger. That's one in two people in the country, UN humanitarians warned. Amid continuing restrictions against women and girls, many Afghan families are even less able to help themselves. Here's Anthea Webb, the World Food Programme's Deputy Regional Director for Asia.
In any situation where such an important portion of the population that women represent are unable to go to work, both because they've lost their jobs or because they are afraid to leave their houses or because of newly imposed restrictions, that is bound to have a disproportionate effect on a family's ability to feed themselves.
Even before the Taliban takeover last August, drought triggered dire food insecurity across the country. And although a food emergency has been averted, more than 20,000 people in northeastern Ghor province are facing catastrophic levels of hunger. So far this year, the World Food Programme has reached more than 16 million of the most needy people in Afghanistan, making it the world's largest humanitarian food operation. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has added his voice to international condemnation of the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian-American reporter for Al Jazeera TV was shot dead on Wednesday while covering an operation by Israeli security forces in Jenin. She was a veteran reporter and wearing a protective vest that clearly identified her as a journalist. There is uncertainty about who fired the fatal shot that killed Ms. Akleh. Journalists at the scene reportedly disputed an Israeli account that Palestinian fighters may have been responsible. To North Korea, also known as DPRK, where the UN Health Agency has said that it is committed to help the country respond to COVID-19 after its first declared infection was reported in the media on Thursday. Responding to UN News, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that it was in touch with the authorities but has yet to receive an official report from the country's health ministry after reports that the highly contagious Omicron variant has been identified. Dr. Edwin Salvador, WHO representative to DPR Korea, said that the UN agency had supported the country in developing its national preparedness and response plan for COVID-19. With partners including UN Children's Fund UNICEF and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, WHO also supported DPR Korea's COVID-19 vaccine deployment plan. The headlines there. Now, as far as good news goes, there's not a lot of it about these days, although this week we do have something to put a smile on your face. It's the wonderful announcement that vaccine trials for malaria in three African countries, Ghana, Kenya and Malawi, have been successful, with children's lives saved, as I found out from Dr. Mary Hamill, Senior Technical Officer at the World Health Organization. Here she is now.
More than 1 million children have now received the world's first malaria vaccine and are benefiting from that added protection they're getting from the vaccine. And that is a real breakthrough. This is the first vaccine that we've had against malaria. It reduces severe malaria, severe illness, and death from malaria. So it's a new tool at a time when we need a new tool and need to make major new advances against malaria.
It is an excellent initiative and it's going to save lots of lives. Maybe you could just explain, why is malaria so deadly? What is it about it that means that this vaccine is a real lifesaver?
Many people don't know that malaria continues to be a primary cause of childhood death worldwide, with the majority of those deaths happening in sub-Saharan Africa. Every year, almost 500,000 children die from malaria. That's a tragic, huge number of children from a disease that's both preventable and treatable. But the problem is that malaria progresses very rapidly. From the time of first fever to death, it could take just 24 to 48 hours. And this is why prevention is so important. Many parents can't get to a facility that could adequately treat malaria in such a short time period. So this vaccine is one of a handful of tools we have to prevent malaria. And when we layer those tools, because none of them are 100% effective, we can see some really important impact and reductions in malaria.
Thank you for that explanation. I think people might be interested to know about this vaccine, a bit more about it. And is it safe?
So this vaccine is safe, it's impactful, and we know from the pilot implementations that are ongoing in Malawi, Ghana, and Kenya that parents want this vaccine. And they bring their children in very high numbers. And we saw this even in the time of a global pandemic, that 70, 80, 90% of children when they were 5 or 6 months of age were brought in for this vaccine for the first dose. So the vaccine works by stimulating the body's own immune system to fight the very first stage of the malaria parasite as it enters the body, right when the mosquito bites the person and injects the malaria parasite under the skin. This is where the action of the vaccine and the immune response occurs, before that parasite can enter the liver, develop, and come out into the bloodstream and cause symptoms.
So you've had these promising results from Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi, as you say. Maybe you could give us a bit more of this good news. I mean, how many children could it potentially save?
It's estimated that if this vaccine was rolled out across sub-Saharan Africa, as it's recommended in areas of moderate to high malaria transmission, 40,000 to 80,000 additional child lives could be saved each year.
That is wonderful. And I guess the next question is, who's going to pay for this? How do countries get hold of it? We've had so much concern and real disbelief over the lack of COVID vaccines. I mean, this one is needed more urgently than ever.
This vaccine is going to be supported and reach children through a global alliance called the Global Alliance for Vaccine Initiative, Gavi. And Gavi supports low and middle income countries to receive vaccines through a scheme they have that allows the vaccines to be provided to countries at very low costs. Now, there is an urgency to get this vaccine to children because children are dying every minute from malaria. But we do have a gap in supply. There's only one manufacturer. There's no other market for a malaria vaccine other than low resource areas, so it hasn't been sold elsewhere before now. So that manufacturer is scaling up their manufacturing now, and yet we know that countries want this vaccine right now. So WHO is working with the manufacturer and other manufacturers and waiting for results for the next vaccines to come forward.
Fantastic. And outside sub-Saharan Africa, where's the other major malaria-affected region? Because I think you said the continent of Africa represented 90% of all cases, but that's not to say that there isn't need for this vaccine elsewhere.
Yeah, there are other places with malaria. There's malaria in India, in Indonesia, in South America, and other places. Sub-Saharan Africa, where the majority of the burden is right now. But as we have more supply, the vaccine could potentially be used in other places as well.
Thanks very much indeed to the UN Health Agency's Dr. Mary Hamill for taking the time to explain just how groundbreaking this malaria vaccine is. and how welcome it is for parents who struggle to get their kids the prompt medical care they need when they fall sick, because there's just not enough investment in healthcare where they live, even though the WHO has been telling us that we need it for decades. We'll have to leave that discussion for another day, though, because Solange Bejetegui-Cortez is with me now with her own memories of malaria busting for the UN back in Bolivia. Hi, Sol.
Hola, Daniel. The first time I heard about malaria was in the 90s. As a consultant for the UN Indigenous Program in Bolivia, I had to travel to Monte Azul, a small community in the north of the country, at the border with Brazil. You can reach Monte Azul only by boat, on the Amazon River, or by air. When we arrived, there were some cases of malaria and no medicines to help. Our pilot refused to sleep there, even though we were supposed to stay 2 days. He said that female mosquitoes bite especially at night. I was young and unaware of the real danger. Malaria was something that happens to others. We decided to spend the night in Cobija, the nearest village to Monte Azul, at the very top of the country. And we came back the next day with malaria medicines. In Monte Azul, malaria was an inevitable fact of life, part of the landscape, death with wings. The medicines were effective, but only a temporary solution. Today, the vaccine against malaria gives us real hope. It is a great moment for the humanity. I just hope it will reach Monte Azul. When I think that something as small as a mosquito can cause such a big damage, I understand why some people call them the world's perfect killer. They are a sort of female Dracula crossing centuries, causing death. Daniel, do you know that Shakespeare mentioned ague, an old English word for malaria, in 8 of his plays? In The Tempest, Stefano mistakes his trembling and delirium for an attack of malaria and tries to cure the symptoms by drinking alcohol. We have often spoken about how misinformation has helped the coronavirus to spread, and here we can see that the same applies to malaria. Yes, the discovery of the first vaccine against malaria is historic, but it is one thing to discover it and quite another to ensure its equal distribution. We face similar problems trying to reach distribute vaccines for COVID-19, and many areas are still not getting what they need. Hopefully, though, lessons have been learned, experience gained, and the efforts to reach communities will continue and improve. The job starts now, from sub-Saharan countries to Monte Azul, where people are not able to access vaccines. The vaccines need to go to them. Perhaps we should ask mosquitoes how to reach them.
Thanks, Sol. That is a super idea. And of course, mosquitoes have been genetically engineered to cause infertility in a bid to eradicate malaria, so that's sort of along the same lines. I think also that it's worth underscoring what Dr. Hamill said just now about vaccines being only one part of the answer against malaria. We need more bed nets. We need fewer places for mosquitoes to breed, along with better education of the risks. And yes, of course, more money spent on helping remote communities from Africa to Asia and South America. Listeners, that's it for this week's show. Thank you so much for following the work of the United Nations. It's great to have you with us wherever you are. Please share this with your nearest and dearest because we do appreciate it. We'll be back next week with an interview with the wonderful Cameroon women's land rights activist, Cecile Njebet, on the work of her association to ensure that one half of the population has the opportunity to work the land and to own some of it too. She is irrepressible, and I hope you'll join us. Until then, bye-bye for now. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Human Rights Council met in special session on Thursday in Geneva, prompted by increasing concern over atrocities committed against civilians following Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. A mounting number of reports and testimonies point to possible war crimes in Ukraine, particularly in areas controlled until recently by Russian forces, said UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet.
These killings of civilians often appear to be intentional, carried out by snipers and soldiers. Civilians were killed when crossing the road or leaving their shelters to seek food and water.
Highlighting the latest harrowing findings of UN investigators in the Kyiv and Chernihiv regions, Ms. Bachelet told the forum that 1,000 civilian bodies had been found in the Kyiv region alone. Some had been killed in hostilities, but others appeared to have been summarily executed. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has added his voice to international condemnation of the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian-American reporter for Al Jazeera TV was shot dead on Wednesday while covering an operation by Israeli security forces in Jenin. She was a veteran reporter and wearing a protective vest that clearly identified her as a journalist. In a statement, Mr. Guterres said that he was appalled by the killing before calling for an independent investigation into the incident so that those responsible can be held accountable. There is uncertainty about who fired the fatal shot that killed Ms. Akleh. Journalists at the scene reportedly disputed an Israeli account that Palestinian fighters may have been responsible. To North Korea, also known as DPRK, where the UN Health Agency has said that it is committed to help the country respond to COVID-19 after its first declared infection was reported in the media on Thursday. Responding to UN News, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that it was in touch with the authorities but has yet to receive an official report from the country's health ministry after reports that the highly contagious Omicron variant has been identified. Dr. Edwin Salvador, WHO representative to DPR Korea, said that the UN agency had supported the country in developing its national preparedness and response plan for COVID-19. With partners including UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, WHO also supported DPR Korea's COVID-19 vaccine deployment plan. The country is eligible to receive COVID-19 vaccines through the UN-partnered COVAX scheme. Daniel Johnson, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. As UN-led global food security discussions began on Wednesday in Rome, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that war in Ukraine had already inflamed a crisis of food, energy and finance that has affected the world's most vulnerable people. Speaking alongside Austria's President Alexander van der Bellen in Vienna, the UN chief said that global food security had been the focus of his recent meetings in Moscow and Kyiv after Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February. "We need quick and decisive action to ensure a steady flow of food and energy in open markets," he said, recommending the lifting of export restrictions, allocating surpluses and reserves to those in need, and addressing food price increases. Despite the war, Mr. Guterres insisted that a meaningful solution to global food insecurity requires reintegrating into world markets Ukraine's harvests and Russia's and Belarus's food production. Meanwhile, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, brought together European and Central Asian countries to find solutions to the war's impact on global agri-food systems. It has also launched a rapid response plan to provide life and livelihood-saving support to farmers who cannot meet their basic food needs. Staying with Ukraine, almost 5 million jobs have been lost in the country over the last 2.5 months, the UN labor agency ILO said. New ILO data shows that the war has led to a 30% drop in employment, and the agency predicts that if conflict continues, 7 million people could be out of work in Ukraine. Here's Heinz Schöller, ILO's Regional Director for Europe and Central Asia, speaking in Geneva.
According to estimates from the Ukrainian Employers Organization, up to 50% of the enterprises are either out of operation or really seriously limited in the operation. And finally, there's obviously the massive global impact through various channels, in particular the rising energy and food prices, which will have a negative impact on employment, in particular in the low and middle developed countries.
ILO also anticipates that neighboring countries hosting Ukraine's 6 million refugees could also struggle because of additional pressures on their labor markets and welfare systems, and any economic deterioration within Russia would likely force migrant workers to return home, significantly affecting remittances. The UN and Netherlands have co-chaired a pledging event in The Hague to prevent an environmental disaster by rescuing rusting oil supertanker FSO Safir off the coast of Yemen. The vessel, moored off the key western port of Hodeidah, holds four times the amount of oil that caused the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. After more than 7 years of war, the UN warned that such a spill would cause lasting environmental damage with profound economic costs across the region and disrupt shipping through the Bab al-Mandab Strait and the Suez Canal, resulting in daily trade losses of billions of dollars. As an oil spill cleanup is estimated at $20 billion, the pledging conference aims to secure funding for a rescue plan that would save tens of billions of dollars in the future, said a UN statement. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Liz Scafidi at UN News. As the war in Ukraine grinds on, the work of UN investigators has continued with the harrowing task of gathering testimonies and evidence of potential war crimes. To date, the deaths of more than 3,300 civilians have been painstakingly confirmed by the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, which readily admits that the actual number will likely be many thousands more. In an interview with UN News, the head of the mission, Matilda Bogner, gives an overview of the investigation's progress since the Russian invasion of Ukraine on 24 February.
Well, we just visited areas to the north of Kyiv where there were very severe violations taking place. We documented a range of violations. Some of this is already known, unlawful killings, including summary executions. We documented conflict-related sexual violence. This has been very difficult to document. Many people are not willing to speak. There's a lot of stigma around it, and certainly nobody should be pushed to speak. But it's also important for us to understand that these types of violations are taking place so that we can try to prevent future violations as well as to try to have accountability for the violations. We also documented cases of civilians being taken, usually men, by Russian forces to Belarus and then into Russia, and where they are now being held in pretrial detention centers. This was something new for us that we had not been aware of before going on this trip.
And this new information that you have on these men being taken to Belarus and Russia, you say you got this because you were on the ground and able to talk to victims of violence. What did they tell you?
Well, at first we were hearing rumors that this was the case, that Russian forces had taken a large group of men.
How many are we talking about?
We were told around 70 or 100. Different people gave us different figures. But we were able to document a handful of such cases. So we really don't know the scale, but we do know that there are such cases.
Without wishing to repeat the horrors that these people have lived, maybe you could just give me one example, maybe the one that really stuck out for you, that may be used later in evidence for accountability.
Yes, there was one example that really did stick out for me. We were going to different houses, just talking to people along the areas where we knew that there had been summary executions. So we knocked on the gate of one house and an elderly man came out. He explained that he and a number of other men had remained in the area to look after their houses after their wives and children had evacuated. And one day Russian forces came. They asked these men to come out onto the street. They looked through their telephones and they identified one individual who had something of concern to them in the telephone. They then took that individual into the forest 100 meters away, and the man we spoke to heard shots. They understood that he had been executed. They asked the Russian forces if they could bury the body. They said, you can bury him in the evening. So they went back in the evening and they buried their neighbor. So this was just one example of many that we heard of summary executions.
And where was this?
This was in Bucha.
This was in Bucha. Okay, so I was going to ask you about whether you've seen these events mirrored across Ukraine.
We have seen similar cases, unlawful killings, summary executions in areas to the north of Kiev, as well as in areas around Chernihiv, again north of Kiev. We have not documented it across the country. It's been specifically in these areas.
You have around 50 or so, 55 officers working for the Ukraine Human Rights Probe in the country. What's your access like, given that you have been there since 2014? You must have some sort of contact with the Russian-affiliated forces in the east.
Yes, we have an office in Donetsk. So we continue to work there, and we have strong networks across the country because we've been working there for years, and that allows us to access information even when we don't have physical access to certain areas.
Mariupol, what's the latest from there?
Well, we used to have an office in Mariupol. We were lucky that we were able to evacuate all of our staff. But again, we have strong networks. We know people there, and we have been following the situation since the beginning. The situation is quickly changing, and we will need to look into it further to see how people are living under the Russian occupation there now.
But for the time being, you have no access to Mariupol after the evacuations of those from the steelworks on the coast.
We have not been able to physically access Mariupol, no.
Let's talk about what you found so far in terms of violations that may have been committed by Ukrainian forces, because that's something that we don't hear too much about. What details do you have on that score, please?
We are very concerned about the treatment of prisoners of war. We have received information that there has been torture and ill treatment. There are even allegations of summary executions of prisoners of war. I know that the Ukrainian authorities have opened an investigation into some of these allegations, so we very much call on the Ukrainian authorities to do a prompt and thorough, effective investigation into those allegations. There are also allegations on the Russian side that they've similarly mistreated and tortured Ukrainian prisoners of war. So Russia also needs to investigate.
And once you have this information, you're going to be presenting some of it to the Human Rights Council. There's a special session happening here in Geneva on Thursday. Then there's going to be a regular session in July where the Commission of Inquiry may make a presentation equally. Following that, what is the accountability process? How far are you expecting this to go?
Well, we're currently preparing a report that we will release in June and that will then be discussed at the Interactive Dialogue in the Human Rights Council in July. Our job is to really monitor and to document. We put down in black and white what we have found, and then others take that further to look for accountability. But we also clearly talk to governments. We encourage accountability to be taken forward. We met, for example, last week with the General Prosecutor's Office in Ukraine, and they have opened a number of criminal cases. So we are in dialogue and are encouraging all forms of accountability from national to international mechanisms.
Do you compile lists of names?
We have a database in which we keep all of the information related to what we have documented, yes.
And in terms of technology for the investigation, we've seen the satellite imagery of the destruction that's been caused inside Ukraine. But in terms of your own investigations, what capacity do you have to use, I don't know, algorithms to figure out where missiles may have been sent from and landed?
We have been using satellite imagery to look at damage and destruction of buildings and so on. We don't have full expertise to do the level of technical work that you're referring to.
And last question to you. I don't think I've really asked you yet. I don't think we have an idea about the total number of civilian casualties, and the UN Rights Office has said that it can't quantify and confirm the actual number of casualties. Can you give us a ballpark figure, please?
Well, we have released our civilian casualty figures. These are fully documented cases where each individual case we've looked at and found on the balance of probabilities this is a civilian casualty. We have been looking at estimates. We certainly do estimate that in Mariupol, which is the area where we have least information and we believe they have the highest number of casualties, that there have been thousands of deaths. But for now, I can't say more than that.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres began a two-day tour of Moldova on Monday to express his solidarity and gratitude to the country's people for taking in nearly 500,000 refugees from Ukraine since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February. In addition to holding talks in the capital, Chisinau, with President Maia Sandu and other senior officials, Mr. Guterres is due to visit a refugee centre run with the support of UN agencies, offering people temporary places to stay, hot meals and the opportunity to register for cash assistance. The Secretary-General was also scheduled to meet one of the many families who have taken in the majority of refugees from Ukraine in Moldova. To date, more than 5.8 million people have fled shelling and fighting in Ukraine across its borders, according to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. In a related development, the UN Economic Commission for Europe, UNECE, announced that it's joined forces with star architect Norman Foster to rebuild Kharkiv in northeast Ukraine. About 25% of housing has been destroyed by bombing in Kharkiv since the Russian invasion, the city's mayor Igor Terekhov said, but administrative buildings, schools, nurseries, cultural centres, infrastructure and power stations have also been damaged, all of which will need reconstructing. Here's Norman Foster now.
This is an extraordinary opportunity to combine the best, the most loved aspects of a city with the city of the future, which has been described to me very eloquently by the mayor in terms of how he sees his city as a city of culture, a city of industry, of advanced technology, and how one builds on that for the future.
The UN for Kharkiv Task Force comprises more than 10 UN agencies which are working together to support the efforts of the government in developing innovative approaches to rebuilding cities in Ukraine. Drought in Ethiopia, the country's worst in 40 years, is believed to be behind an increase in maternal and newborn deaths in recent months. UN humanitarians warned on Monday. In an alert from the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, it reported that pregnant women with labour complications and no transport had travelled up to 200 kilometres to get medical help in Ethiopia's Somali region. Women and girls are the hardest hit by the climate crisis, the UN agency said, noting that in eastern and southern Ethiopia, seasonal rains have failed for the third time since late 2020. This has fueled mass displacement and deepened an already dire humanitarian situation. Nearly 8 million people have been affected, UNFPA said, and more than 286,000 Ethiopian Somalis have been displaced, fleeing their homes to survive as crops, livestock and livelihoods are wiped out. In the Somali region, some 930,000 people need emergency and reproductive health support, and more than 565,000 people have reduced access to protection services. This includes women, children and survivors of gender-based violence. UNFPA cited data from the Ethiopian Public Health Institute showing that more than 60% of those living in the Somali region are over an hour's walk away from the nearest health facility, which may or may not be functioning, even if they do manage to reach it. UN-led talks on space security began on Monday in a bid to find common ground among member states and manage the growing number of risks to global peace. The first open-ended working group on reducing space threats, taking place all this week in Geneva, follows a UN General Assembly resolution last December, seeking to promote norms, rules and principles of responsible behaviours on space-based threats. Progress on disarmament is also a key priority of UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, who recently reported on ways to reduce the risks of misunderstanding and miscalculations on outer space issues. An international treaty for outer space already exists that forms the basis of international space law, but it is 55 years old and needs updating urgently, said Helmut Lagos, who's chairing the talks in Geneva on reducing space threats. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Liz Scafidi at UN News. As if there weren't enough problems to worry about down here on Earth, there is a growing number of threats to global peace in outer space, too, which is why UN-led talks are underway all this week in Geneva to find common ground on cosmic security. Chairing the first open-ended working group on reducing space threats, veteran Chilean diplomat Helmut Lagos explained to UN News' Daniel Johnson why space matters to us all and what member states are most concerned about.
The main mission of this open-ended working group in its first session this week is to try to start to find a common ground, a common understanding about how to identify our main threats to space security and how to make recommendations on norms, rules and principles to improve space security by addressing the responsible behavior of states that can provoke threats and risks to this security for all nations.
So you talk about risks in outer space, and most people probably know about anti-satellite busting technology, which has been deployed in the recent past, certainly, and also the dangers created by the fragments, the millions of fragments that must be orbiting around Earth, which are a danger to those in the space station, for example. I mean, space security affects us all, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It affects not only the spacefaring nations, but also the emerging spacefaring nations and all the rest of the world, even those that are not aware of it. Because our daily lives, the most basic things that we do in life, in modern life, they are dependent on these technologies and services that come from space.
GPS and the like?
Exactly. GPS, critical infrastructure, energy, everything. Everything is controlled by space technologies.
So it's very precious to everybody on Earth. You have lots of member states here. What's the representation, please? And maybe the civil society too, because that's equally important this week.
Absolutely. We have representations from all regions of the world. Everybody is becoming increasingly aware of the importance of this issue. And in order to be able to have a success, we need to be inclusive and we need to engage all representations. And as you just mentioned, civil society is extremely important, not only because there are increasing number of non-state actors in space, but also because their participation in these multilateral processes, they give an additional layer of legitimacy to the results, to the outcome of the process.
We're 3 days into the talks now, this open-ended working group. You're going to have another 3 discussions. The next one will be in September. You aim to come up with a consensus document at the end of this week to take to the next set of discussions. But outside the United Nations here in Geneva, we have conflict, we have war in Ukraine as well. How has that impacted on the general feel and the tenor of the discussions happening today?
For those of us who have been doing multilateral diplomacy, particularly regarding international security, we are used to work in a very adverse international context. The conditions are never the best. It is obvious that the geopolitical context now is really concerning and it has an impact on all the discussions and in all the processes all over the world. That does not exclude us. But that said, we are trying to have a positive momentum in this process, at least to try to make progress because it is in everybody's interest. And so far, we have achieved that. We see that there is a big engagement and interest in moving this forward. And I am confident that we will keep up that good spirit so that we can finally have that outcome that we all are working for, that consensus outcome at the end.
So the P5 are here in the room?
They are all here.
Great. And let's move on to the existing space treaty that exists.
Yes.
What's wrong with it? I mean, it's 50 years old, but it covers what happens in space. What are you trying to do to it? Why do you need to improve it?
There is nothing wrong with it. The problem is that it was negotiated 55 years ago, and so we need to update it. It doesn't have a review mechanism, as we see with other important treaties. So to answer your question, that treaty is actually the cornerstone of the international space regime. That is still true. But at the same time, we need to see what other norms, principles, and rules can be negotiated to fill the legal gaps that are there, considering how the space environment has evolved in the last couple of decades dramatically.
So the Outer Space Treaty prohibits the use of nuclear weapons in space, but it doesn't necessarily cover new technologies. That's one of the things you're trying to cover.
Absolutely, because in 1967, nobody envisaged the development of other technologies and other types of weapons and systems that could be used in space. That's the reason why the only weapons that are specifically prohibited in that treaty are nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction.
So what sort of force do you have to bring about the change that you need to update this treaty, because you can't enforce anything in outer space? So who's going to lead this change?
Well, there have been in the last couple of decades many initiatives to develop new norms. The approach has not been satisfactory in its results, because the nature of the mandate of the work that these other initiatives were leading was, in my opinion, too specific. This new process, which comes as a result of a resolution of the United Nations General Assembly, allows for different types of outcomes, which means that different views and different ideas from delegations can be put together in one document of recommendations, and maybe that can in the future be turned into a legally binding instrument that addresses the different threat perceptions that still exist. And they are very different, because you mentioned anti-satellite systems as one of them, but that's not the only one. There are other states that are very worried about the possible placement of weapons in outer space. But all of this comes together in the shared concern about the prevention of an arms race in outer space. So to put that all together in one document that could potentially be turned into a legally binding instrument, that would be the ideal result that many delegations are looking for.
So what's the sort of end date that we're looking at for a potentially binding legal treaty to come out of these open-ended discussions?
We cannot now say how long it will take, and we cannot even say whether the result will be immediately a legally binding treaty, but maybe it can be the development of voluntary norms, political measures, soft law initiatives, and all of them considering it as a gradual process that will build up for that legally binding treaty in the future. But I cannot now say how many years. I mean, that's not how diplomacy works, unfortunately.
Right. And final question to you, Ambassador. You're from Chile. You're leading the discussions here. What does Chile bring to the discussions? What does Chile want from the discussions?
Well, Chile is a state that has always tried to work for the strengthening of the international legal regime through the collaboration and all the tools that multilateral diplomacy give us. And at the same time, we are an example of a state, a nation that is not spacefaring, but we are equally interested in this because we all depend on these technologies. It shows you that this should not be an exclusive, a little limited discussion among some nations that have these capabilities, but actually it should involve all of the states. And we are trying to make a modest contribution to this goal, which is a global goal. It is for the well-being of everybody and for the preservation of peace.
This is Anna Carmo with UN News. If you like political cartoons, chances are that you've come across the work of Patrick Chapatz in leading international newspapers and journals. In addition to his prolific output, Mr. Chapatz is also president of the Freedom Cartoonists Foundation. To coincide with World Press Freedom Day 2022 on May 3rd, it's unveiled a new exhibition in Geneva, featuring drawings by other top illustrators who take great risks to stand up to authority. Here he is now explaining to UN News' Daniel Johnson how the challenges to a free press seem to be proliferating and why it's so important to push back against those who would stifle free speech.
How I choose what I want to draw in my cartoons, actually over the last, I would say, month or years, I haven't had much of a choice. The news has imposed itself, and what is pretty special and particular is that a single news has imposed itself. First, it was COVID. For almost 2 years, we cartoonists have been churning out cartoons about COVID and in all its aspects, be it economical, of course, health question, societal, everything. It was the news. And then we are being totally engulfed. We have been engulfed for the last weeks by the Ukraine conflict. And that's taking all the place. And who knows what will be next. So from time to time, I find a way to squeeze in a cartoon, as you can imagine, on Elon Musk buying Twitter and other more, shall I say, relaxing news. I don't know, but it's a very intense period of time.
What's your message then for World Press Freedom Day on Tuesday, May the 3rd?
We thought with the Freedom Cartoonist Foundation that I'm leading now in Geneva, formerly it was the Swiss Foundation Cartooning for Peace. Cartooning for Peace is a network of more than 200 cartoonists worldwide, still based in Paris. But our foundation in Geneva, which has been bestowing an award since 2012, an international award to salute cartoonists not only for their talent, but for their courage. We thought it would be very important to mark this World Press Freedom Day, taking cartoons as something symbolic, a symbol of a free press. You know, cartoons, political cartoons, were born with the fight for a free press. You can think of that particular story in France that is closer to us in Geneva. In the 19th century, the very courageous fight for newspapers to exist and free voices to exist was accompanied by political cartoons, which brought some of the cartoonists in jail. And we can think of Daumier, the godfather of cartoonists, and his editor, Philippon, taking on the king. So in that memory, we wanted to mark World Press Freedom Day, not only to salute cartoonists, but to salute journalists. Journalists who have been paying a huge toll, if you think of the Ukraine war right now, the number of journalists who have been killed or wounded. Journalists who are at the forefront of a global fight for democracy through the fight against fake news. And I think that real information and real journalism is more important today, more important than ever. That's why we wanted to pay tribute not only to political cartooning, but to journalism and a free press.
So maybe we could just dig a little bit deeper into the Freedom Cartoonist Foundation awards this year. What's the representation from across the globe that you're putting on display in Geneva at the moment?
So we've been giving this award since 2012. It's a biennial award every 2 years. We had winners from Iran, the young generation of Iranian cartoonists, half in exile, half still in Tehran. We had winners from Palestine, Egypt. We had anti-corruption cartoonists who won in Malaysia and in Kenya. And 4 years ago, because again, COVID happened 2 years ago and we were not able to give the award. 4 years ago, we gave our award to Muzakart of Turkey, a man who was in jail. He was not able to come to Geneva to receive his award. His wife has to come in his place. He was jailed for what? For doing cartoons in Turkey's Erdogan. That's the reality on the ground today for some cartoonists. So it's a big moment for us. It had been 4 years since the last award. So we wanted to make it really a very powerful and strong moment. We were pleased to announce that the award will now be named the Kofi Annan Courage in Cartooning Award. And that's with the Kofi Annan Foundation's blessing and in memory of Kofi Annan, who was, and that's not well known, not only a Nobel Peace Laureate, not only the former, of course, UN Secretary General, but he was a big fan and defensor of political cartoons.
I was going to ask you about that. Why do you think Kofi Annan was so keen on cartoons? Because they can be so undiplomatic and dangerous. Cartoons are such an easy target. Why is that, do you think?
You could imagine maybe for wrong reasons, in the sense that politicians like to see themselves represented, especially in cartoons. Even if it, you know, the slogan, bad publicity is still publicity, and being in a cartoon is seen as a badge of honor, even if it's a tough cartoon. But that's not. Knowing Kofi Annan, I know he was a big proponent of the arts and of political cartoons. And to give you an example, because he was, you know, a very discreet person, Kofi, when Muzakart was not able to come to Geneva to receive his award, I know that Kofi Annan shared with us that he had personally written to Erdogan, to the president of Turkey, to plead the cause of Muzakart. So you can see that his involvement, it was not just symbolic, it was a real involvement, because I think he believed very strongly in the power of cartoons and in the importance of critical voices and of a free press. That is the conviction I got with my dealings with him. And that's why we thought it would be a good idea to have his name representing this award.
Thank you for that. And of course, he's well known for his wonderful smile and sense of humor. So that's perhaps also where the cartoons come in. Nonetheless, there are huge concerns around the world, not only Ukraine. There are so many crises, forgotten crises, from Syria to the Central African Republic, Yemen, could go on. 29 journalists have also been killed so far this year, from Haiti to Myanmar, Mexico, Pakistan, Ukraine and beyond. Is it worth the risk to keep putting people's lives in danger?
Oh my, is it worth the risk to defend democracy and to defend freedom? Of course, people will answer, people on the ground. I'm talking on behalf of journalists, of not only journalists going to dangerous places, but journalists here in newsrooms doing the very important work of investigative journalism. And I'm talking also of political cartoonists who are often described as the canary in the coal mine. You know, when the canary dies, it means that there is danger in the air. And when the people in power target cartoonists, very often, it's a barometer of freedom in a society. And it's very often the cartoonist who gets targeted first. And if you look at the laureates of our prize this year, I think they both really symbolize those dangers to democracy and to peace that we are facing today. One of them is Gabor Papai from Hungary. And that is a country at the heart of the European Union where civil liberties and freedom of the press are being more and more squeezed. And he has been targeted personally for his cartoons. And then you have Vladimir Kazanevsky, a beautiful, wonderful cartoonist from Ukraine, who had to flee his country under bombs and under attack, and is now in Slovakia, still doing the important work of denouncing the aggression and caricaturing Putin, the aggressor, showing that the king is naked. Putin is naked in Vladimir's cartoons.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chapat. Last question to you. A while ago, 3 years ago now, the New York Times decided to stop printing political cartoons, and you used to work for the New York Times. And then you said that there was this fear of these moralistic mobs who have the upper hand online. I mean, it's still the case, isn't it? You said that these moralistic mobs really are organized in the way that they work. And so what would the answer be? How do you push back against those who would curtail press freedom?
Well, that is another huge threat to liberties and to democracy, frankly. It's not only the threat from the outside. It's not only the threat from the autocrats. It is the threat from the total change we have seen in the world of the media, where social media and social platforms have taken, frankly, the place of the traditional media. And those are places where you don't know, you don't identify the voices. Those are very powerful tools that are being used by pressure groups. And you are now able to really launch a real campaign of disinformation and attacks on people, on institutions, on cartoonists in some cases, without knowing from where the attack comes and without really understanding the scope of it. And people join the crowd. It's the satisfaction of the instant click to feel that you are on the right side of a debate without any debate taking place, actually. So I think we have a real danger. And we had two very important figures joining us on May 3, the two Nobel Peace laureates, Maria Ressa from the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov of Russia. Those guys are heroes. It's the first time since 80 years that journalists have been recognized with the Nobel Prize. And I'm thinking about Maria Ressa's very important work, specifically against fake news, disinformation, and the toxic power of social media. I think that's one of the big challenges we are all facing as a society, not only journalists, but our societies. The democratic societies are threatened from the inside if we don't take some measures to just harness and make those platforms just honest.
Control, eradication. Control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
That's the British actor Michael Redgrave at the microphone in 1958, highlighting the core philosophy on which the World Health Organization, WHO, was founded and to which it still aspires today. I'm Omar Musni, and welcome to another classic podcast from the vaults of our unique audiovisual archive here at UN headquarters in New York. Everyone everywhere has a right to benefit from health services they need without sacrificing other life necessities, and everyone can play a part on the path to universal health care. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus addressed the issue immediately upon his election as WHO Director General.
At present, only about half of the world's people have access to health care without impoverishment. This needs to improve dramatically.
Indeed, on the occasion of World Health Day, the WHO data make it clear billions around the world are still missing out on basic services, while 100 million are being pushed into extreme poverty due to crippling health care costs. But as we are about to hear in this UN Radio, WHO, and BBC collaboration, enormous progress had already been made in the Health Watchdog's first 10 years and continue 60 years later. Listen now as 10 Steps Forward takes us backwards in time to when disease ran rampant in the streets of even the most advanced societies on Earth.
Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead.
Death carts in the streets, red crosses of warning on the doors, corpses tumbled naked into the plague pits. That was London in 1665.
Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead.
Epidemiological Bulletin of the World Health Organization's Top. Section 1. This is today on the World Health Organization, created just 10 years ago to keep watch on the health of the world and to deal, among many other things, with such epidemics as that in 1947. Send off the following telegram to the Pasteur Institute in Paris, the Lister Institute in London, the Hafkeen Institute in Bombay.
Seen this cable about cholera vaccine? Well, we've just three questions to answer. How much vaccine have we in hand? And how much more can we produce in a week? How soon can we get it to Cairo? It's quite an order.
Motorcycle escorts to LaGuardia Airport, New York. But not this time escorting a very important person, just a very important vaccine. For that was October 1947, and in Egypt, there were 33,000 cases of cholera. But in a few months...
Geneva, February 18th, 1948. Egypt now declares whole country free from cholera.
A victory for the international guardians of health. WHO did not yet officially exist, but it was already functioning. And 2 months later, on the 7th of April, 1948, its constitution came into force. At a time when, in the words of its first Director General, Dr. Brock Chisholm,
"We had just come out of a catastrophic world war, which had reminded people that ours was a small planet. Until quite recently, man's environment had been his locality only, his village or town, or at the most his own country. He had learned to live more or less at peace with his own emotions and had contrived to get along with his immediate neighbors. Now that situation had changed entirely. The environment of every person was the whole world, and it was essential to the health of every individual that he develop beyond the capacity to live with his own kind of people only and be able to live with all the kinds of people all over the world. This and the concept of health was not just the absence of sickness or of infirmity, but a positive aim, was a new sort of idea. That was why we chose the name World Health Organization."
A new sort of idea on a small planet. A planet which is still divided by frontiers,
But those frontiers, as ever, can be crossed by the carriers of disease, by rat and bat, by insect and virus. They can also be crossed by an idea, especially by this new sort of idea. In your different countries, you have different problems.
We have roughly 1,500 patients, and we are terribly understaffed. Roughly 8 to 10 male nurses and about 10 or 12 female nurses. Most of the work is done by untrained staff who attend to the general needs of the patient.
That is a mental hospital in Singapore.
The local society for the welfare of crippled children in Lebanon was formed chiefly through the good offices of a Dr. Harfouche. She was rather appalled by the large number of undernourished and crippled children in Lebanon and indeed throughout the whole of the Middle East.
While further east still, in the Punjab in India.
It was a little difficult. At first we had to get cooperation of the village dai or local midwife, and we tried to get her to realize that she needed a certain amount of training.
Training is nearly everywhere a problem. Training of midwives, training of nurses.
It's very difficult to get suitable girls of a good standard of education to be nurses.
So says one of the few women doctors in Iraq.
There's a constant argument that goes on as to what kind of food a child ought to be given at any stage. Also, there's a constant difference of opinion as to the proper kinds of food for mothers after they've been delivered.
That is in Formosa, an island where, in fact...
In fact, in some areas there were no roads at all, and the midwife had to rush along on a bicycle between the rice paddies either side along a path that was carefully 18 inches wide, and she wobbled along here until she reached a river, and when she reached the river, off she had to come off her bicycle, fling the bicycle over her shoulder, and go across the river as best she could.
Yes, different problems in different countries. But the end is everywhere the same. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So runs the first clause in our Constitution. And every year, at the World Health Assembly, East meets West to discuss that aim. We talk of privileged countries and underdeveloped countries, but in health, there's no one-way traffic. A two-way, a many-way traffic. And we're now controlling it better, with signposts and lights and rules of the road. WHO holds a watching brief, watching and checking and double-checking and warning.
Section 1, week ended 20th July, cholera, Pakistan, Chittagong 1, India, Calcutta 36, stop, smallpox, Sierra Leone, Freetown 5, Sudan, Port Sudan 2, Pakistan, Karachi 2, Lahore 3.
A constant eye for infectious diseases. In these last 10 years, such diseases have rapidly decreased. Look at the historic scourges like cholera, typhus, smallpox, plague, relapsing fever, yellow fever. But WHO is not only concerned with epidemics, it's concerned with your whole life, from the cradle, and indeed from before it.
Schlafe, mein Prinzchen, schlaf ein, es ruhen nun Schäfchen und Vögelein.
This cradle song used to be attributed to Mozart. We now know that it was composed by an amateur musician, a doctor of medicine, in Berlin towards the end of the 18th century. When conditions in Berlin and all through Europe were as bad as they are now in the underdeveloped countries, mothers continually dying in childbirth, children dying at birth or in infancy. Dr. Bernhard Fleece's lullaby is still sung. Sleep, my little prince, go to sleep. But now, he's more likely to sleep sound. Sleep, come to the eyes of my child. Your uncle, the moon, will enrich your dreams. So Indian mothers sing in Hindi. But they and their children are still surrounded by perils. It is those perils that WHO is combating. The welfare of mother and child is one of its chief concerns. And already in many countries this work is bearing fruit. The child is more likely to sleep sound, the music less likely to break off. After the danger of birth comes the danger of weaning. There is a disease of small children which often leads to death before the child's third birthday. It is well known to Dr. Omondi, one of the few African doctors in Kenya.
In Kenya, there's a great deal of malnutrition, particularly of children who have previously been weaned and have been put to a diet which is deficient in proteins. And since they cannot get that protein, their growth is deficient, and these children are liable to a lot of infections, such as bronchopneumonia and chronic malaria and worms. So malnutrition is a real problem in Kenya, which is being faced and which I hope will be under control in some time to come.
Undernourished children and crippled children. There are many of the latter in the Lebanon. Dr. Kraft went out there from Britain a few years ago to start up the first Lebanese center for crippled children.
A number of the children were not only located around Beirut, but at distances from the city. Now, Lebanon, as anybody will know, is a country rather more mountainous than Switzerland. Traveling is extremely difficult. Distances, not so much, but it's the traveling. To get anybody to the center at 6 o'clock in the morning meant leaving at midnight the night before. So we had to make a very large dormitory. This proved wonderfully successful.
So it goes on, watching the mother before and during and after the birth of her child, and watching that child in turn through the years of its growing up. And as it grows up, some menaces fall away, but new ones will take their place. It's the same with countries. As a country becomes more developed, certain diseases decrease, but others acquire a new prominence. For instance, poliomyelitis, that disease which can cripple you for life. Dr. A.M. Payne from Geneva has followed and taken part in the campaign against polio since the Second World War.
During and after the last World War, there had been an alarming increase in poliomyelitis in some countries. And this was very disturbing because at that time there was no prospect of being able to do anything about it. But the real breakthrough came in 1949 when Enders and his colleagues discovered that the virus could be grown in tissue culture. This completely altered the prospects of controlling the disease because it opened the possibility of being able to manufacture a vaccine against the disease.
Such a vaccine was manufactured, what is known as an inactivated vaccine. But hopes are now being placed on something more active, more sweeping, a live virus vaccine which will strike at the roots of this disease.
Trials of the live virus vaccine are now going on in the United States, the USSR, the Netherlands, Mexico, South Africa, and they're also being planned in a number of other countries. But meanwhile, of course, considerable success has been recorded in the United States in recent years in reducing the incidence of polio through the use of the Salk vaccine.
But there are other diseases. The malaria, the disease which may have killed Alexander the Great and later destroyed the Roman Empire. A disease which is carried by mosquitoes and can spread like wildfire. In the words of Dr. P.F. Russell, a WHO consultant.
So it goes on and on, mosquito to man to mosquito to man, until almost everyone in a community has the disease. Probably 200 million persons were infected with malaria in this way in 1955. Those who have malaria naturally become anemic. They lack vitality and ambition. Can't farm or work properly, can't provide for their families, get into debt, or maybe die prematurely. Without doubt, malaria is bad for an individual, bad for a community, and bad for a nation.
In the middle 1930s in Ceylon, the malaria death roll was enormous. 10 years later, they took to DDT, and within 3 years, the death rate was down by 82.5%. Ceylon was rightly proud of this achievement. The mosquitoes, it was thought, were defeated. But in regard to malaria, the word control is already out of date. On October the 7th, 1954, a report was received at WHO headquarters. It came from a Greek doctor, Peter Issaris, leader of the malaria team in Indonesia. On the north coast of Java, DDT resistance has appeared in Anopheles sundaicus, which meant that everyone had to think again. Anopheles sundaicus is a malarial mosquito, and, according to this report, to this bombshell, It was breeding itself immune to insecticides. This meant that within a few years, this new breed of resistant mosquitoes would have multiplied to the point where it would menace mankind. So the World Health Assembly of 1955 made a very bold resolution. They resolved to eradicate malaria. And the WHO now has a division of malaria eradication. Its director is Dr. Pampana of Italy.
Well, I think that now you can say that the present policy of WHO is no longer control, but eradication. And as Jacob Mudaliar said in 1957 at the World Health Assembly,
we in India are particularly interested in this program because for many years we have been fighting this scourge of malaria. And I am glad to note from the Director General's report that more and more countries are now coming to believe that the proper way of controlling malaria is not by control, but by eradication.
Control, eradication, control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. And there are other things, too, in this strange new world of ours, which involve a fight against time. Did you expect a clock? No. Those are Geiger counters, which represent a new kind of energy and involve a new attitude to time. This, people say, this is the atomic age. And for better or worse, they are right. And WHO, on behalf of one and all of you, is trying to bring this all-important question into the sphere of the knowable and controllable. Dr. I.S. Eve, who is now in the Director General's office of WHO at Geneva, was previously medical officer at Windscale. It was a logical transfer. His subject is radiation protection.
One of the most important things we think we can do in this subject of protection is training. We are anxious that knowledge of protection measures shall spread across the earth as rapidly as the spread of atomic energy itself. Sir Henry Cowan, Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health for Scotland, has made a very interesting statement at the last World Health Assembly.
The future of the population of the world is indissolubly linked with the development of sources of nuclear energy. Exploitation of new sources of energy, which will flow and develop from the first halting steps in the use of fission processes, can bestow ineffable benefits on mankind. The evolution of these processes can be left to the nuclear physicist, but the hazards are the concern of the biophysicist and the health worker.
The hazards are the concern of all of us. There they go again, the clock of the atomic age, the life pulse of one and all of you. And to some of you, this pulse seems feverish. The thought of it adds to your nervous strain. But your nervous strain, your mental health, is also the concern of WHO. You remember that first clause, first challenge, first statement of faith? Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
Bring out your dead!
No, you're living. Take off that tolling bell. We must bring out our living. Living in every sense, physically, mentally, socially. This small planet is big with the future. And that future will live in our children. And that future itself is like a child. And it has many possibilities. Some of them we have mentioned today, but there are many others which are on the agenda. The agenda of World Health Organization.
That was an edited version of 10 Steps Forward, narrated by British stage and screen actor Michael Redgrave to mark the 10th anniversary of WHO in 1958. As he said, the WHO agenda includes many topics and has since expanded to address such issues as substance abuse, road safety, and clean energy, among others. That's it for this edition of our podcast classics series. You can find a wealth of other audio, film, and video by going to www.unmultimedia.org/AV Library. This unique collection of material goes back to the 1940s and the founding of the United Nations. I'm Omar Musni, and thanks for listening.